My mission is simple, to make you money. I'm here to level the playing field for all investors. There's always a bull market somewhere, and I promise to help you find it. Mad Money starts now.
Hey, I'm Cramer. Welcome to Mad Money. Welcome to Cramerica. Other people are my friends. I'm just trying to make some money. My job is not just to entertain, but to educate, teach you, put it in context. Call me at 1-800-743-CNBC or tweet me at Jim Cramer. No other stock in this market has more pin action than Apple, except for maybe J.P. Morgan or American Express or Honeywell or Union Pacific. That's right. We're in a moment where there are more pluses than minuses, and it's all because the stocks generating positive pin action in this earnings season are a lot more powerful than the stocks generating negative pin action. No wonder the averages rallied today. Dow advancing 57 points. S&P gaining 0.69%. NASDAQ jumping incredibly impressive 0.91%. Sure, there are still plenty of downbeat stories out there. The economy is slowing, Chinese, whatever, averages, call them whatever you want. The farce that is Brexit, the tragic 737 MAX plane crashes, where we are now learning Boeing may have known about the plane's flaws ahead of time. The litigation that's pummeling the pharmaceutical industry. And the overhang from this year's flood of new IPOs, many of which turned out to be gigantic losers. I'm going to flesh out those woes later. But what matters most right now is the action in individual stocks. See, individual stocks, they have no ideology. They won't mislead you. They're not bent, as the cops would say in Line of Duty. Fabulous British detective show. Why don't we start with Apple? I mean, like, you know how much I like to start with Apple. Apple's a stock that's breaking out to new all-time highs. And it's thanks to the incredible popularity of the iPhone 11, which is selling much better than Wall Street expected because it turned out to have this tremendous longer battery and the amazing camera, perfect for Instagram. At the same time, CEO Tim Cook has been able to navigate his way through the trade war much better than almost anybody else I know. He's spending time with the leadership of both countries, with Trump, with Xi. Get this. I think this is perfect about who he really is. He gave the commencement address at Tulane, where my daughter went, and at Stanford this year. But he also just got joined last week the board of the prestigious Tsinghua University of Economics and Management in Beijing. Last week, Cook spoke to China's State Administration for Market Regulation. According to Reuters, he talked about expanding investment in the People's Republic, consumer rights protection, and corporate responsibility. In other words, Cook's not waiting for the trade talks to be resolved. He's not on the sidelines. He's on the front lines. The front lines of the trade war, trying to calm things down. So far, it's working, at least for Apple and its shareholders, who were rewarded with a 1.73% increase, $4.10 gain. Guys, this is a $1 trillion company. It's not supposed to be able to go up $4.10, for heaven's sakes. Now, when Apple's on fire, it has a lot of semiconductor pin action. Oh, let's see. Cirrus Logic, Texas Instruments. How about Broadcom? Skyworks Solutions, Micron. A rally in these stocks can trigger a dramatic move in the whole NASDAQ. It's a mammoth breakout that silences the macro junkies who blather on endlessly about the Fed, the fading inverted yield curve, or a big economic slowdown. It's pretty hard to find if you're examining most domestically oriented companies. Hey, speaking of domestic operators, how about that amazing run in the stock of J.P. Morgan? It's up another $3 today. It is hard to believe that such a high-quality stock still sells for less than 12 times earnings with a yield of nearly 3%. But it's true. See, that's what happens when you report spectacular earnings. The stock of J.P. Morgan, it's ridiculously cheap. You can't have a real bank rally without this one. It's the best of the best. That's why the stock's fabulous move today was a locomotive that pulled Citigroup, it pulled Bank of America, and it pulled Morgan Stanley along with it.
All aboard! All aboard!
Once again, if you were taking the professional pessimist seriously, you never would have been able to capture this move. No way, no how. We've seen so many big-time money managers, hedge funds, they come on our air, and they say it is the end of the world. They're just forget about it. Hey, by the way, they're really rich. And maybe you're not. They've made the money. They don't want you to have it. Or at least, that's what it seems like to me. You know, it's, they think that the financials are the epicenter of the soon-to-self-destruct market, at least until they started reporting last week. Now, it didn't matter that they have consistent mid-single-digit growth. You know, they call this MSD on Wall Street. It's really bugging the heck. Can't they just say the words? Is it harder to say mid-single-digit than it is to say MSD? No. Anyway, it didn't matter that they all have bountiful buybacks and dividends. And it didn't matter that the consumer's in amazing shape. The macro guys don't care about this stuff. They only care about the yield curve. And that's why they got it all wrong. Not that they'll ever tell you that. It's why they've missed out on this terrific bank rally. Oh, memo to these masters of the universe, or at least the macro universe. I feel like a linebacker here. Unless you do some homework, stay the heck out of my zone. Same goes for the strength in the stock of American Express. A lot of times I like to read a company's conference call without knowing where its stock might be trading. It's a great discipline because it prevents you from following the herd. When American Express reported, I thought the conference call was solid. It was a good growth, a tremendous millennial pickup. It was one of those quarters that told me American Express, under the leadership of new CEO Stephen Squeri, has become a must-own financial tech. You either own it or you own Visa or you own MasterCard. By the way, Visa and MasterCard both report next week. Sure enough, after initial dip, American Express is now roaring. Closing at $2.29 or $1.96%. Again, a big company, just 2%, just like that. Then there's Honeywell, HON. If you told me there's a company that's levered to aerospace, climate controls, automation, chemicals, I'd say those are exactly the businesses you don't want exposure to, particularly at this point in the cycle. Yet, Honeywell's in fantastic shape. Last week, CEO Darius Adamczyk, now he's Dave Cote's successor, he put on a clinic when he explained how his business is strong worldwide, including China. While the growth in aerospace was downright phenomenal, Honeywell's firing on all cylinders here. Oddly, the only weak business was in warehouse automation. The market accepted it because that division was up against some really tough comparisons. Honeywell's stock on fire. Jumped $3.37 or 2%. Talk about pin action. All throughout the complex. Finally, there's Union Pacific. Everyone thought Union Pacific was this. Wrong. It was this.
All aboard.
I know some people viewed this quarter as a disappointment, as they had so much weakness across so many different cargoes. And I'll give them that. But look, I think exactly the opposite. Exactly. Despite the revenue shortfall, Union Pacific generated some fantastic earnings. If they can make this kind of profit, when business is this bad, can you imagine how much money they'll make when it's good? What happens if we get a trade deal with China or Congress signs up on NAFTA update, whatever they're calling it now? What if the Fed keeps cutting rates? That would produce some extraordinary returns here. No wonder Union Pacific's been leading the transports since it rallied last week. It's picked up just another 5 points, 3.45% just today. Listen, this afternoon, I had the privilege of being on Scott Wapner's fabulous halftime show. What? Can you get it? I mean, you should watch it. It's really thoughtful. We had a spirited discussion led by my good friend Josh Brown. He pointed out the stocks have been able to rally despite all sorts of obstacles, yet the pessimism is still, it's unrelenting. I suggested that perhaps the macro people have too much sway, as they seem oblivious to actual investing. They're indifferent to what's happening in individual companies. I think some of it is sheer intellectual laziness. They don't want to do the homework. Hey, listen, maybe they're gym. Maybe they're watching a lot of Netflix. I don't know. It's easy just to spout off about the big picture stuff like the yield curve, because it doesn't change that much. You can pretty much say the same thing every day unless there's like some, you know, couple of points. Some of it's because the concept of trying to make money in stocks seems to elude them. And some of it is motivated reasoning. They hate Donald Trump so much that they can't bring themselves to believe this has been a pretty terrific period for the stock market and the economy. But at the end of the day, you can't afford to take your cue from people who don't want to do their homework. The bottom line, we're getting some tremendous positive pin action here with some very important companies putting up excellent results, and it's reverberating. Yes, their stocks were higher and drag whole groups with them, as we've seen, even though I've never bowled higher than a 143. I got to tell you, it's pretty encouraging. Now, let's see if the parade starts tomorrow, marches to the same positive music. Why don't we go to Rich in Pennsylvania? Rich!
Mr. Kramer, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Good, good. I am a young investor, and my question is about Spirit Airlines. They're not involved with the MAX, and the airline seems like they're reporting good earnings. I want to get your take from my portfolio.
Right. Well, I mean, look, we have UAL reporting really unbelievable numbers with Oscar Munoz. He just reported a terrific quarter. Gary Kelly, by the way, a lot of people are saying don't buy Southwest here. They're going to report later today, maybe after they report, but both of those are better than Spirit. How about Catherine in Connecticut? Catherine.
Yes.
Catherine, you're up. It's Kramer.
Hi, Kramer.
How you doing?
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you. Since January, I both bought and sold Cronus between 9 and 22, overall earning about 3%.
Good!
After a lot of work. I'm not holding any now. And after hours last Wednesday, when I watched the price paid surge up by as much as 40% into the 12s from the 8s, I wanted to eat my hat as I had just unloaded the last I had at 9.3. Given the quick turnaround plunge back down, you know, I was happy that I followed my instincts and didn't jump back in. I almost did. But so now my question is the newly crowned so-called King of the North a buy in the eighth, or should I hold out for it to dip back into the sevens, or what?
Catherine, I don't know. I mean, look, you've done the right. You made some money here. I mean, congratulations. Most people have lost. The problem with Cronus is the vape thing. Now, I know when we had the CEO, he told us not to worry, but you know what? It's guilt by association. And there's also the PodX. These are the ETFs that just crush these stocks, including GW Pharma. It would really help more if Canopy picked a guy, a woman, guy or gal. You can't use gal anymore, I think, right? Regina, my executive producer, guy or woman. No, gal's out. Gal is out. But you get a person. There you go. You get a person. How about that? Who knows the packaged goods industry? Wow. You could see some perfect pin action there. All right, some stocks are more powerful than others, and boy, oh boy, are they causing positive pin action. I always use the name Beethoven when I bowl. You know, you get to name your name, right? I always like to be somebody else when I bowl. All right, Oman, extraneous, but why not? Oman Money tonight. With so many unknowns trying to gauge what's next for this market, I'm going off the charts to see what the technicals could be signaling. And by the way, they're not signaling any positive. Hey, then we've seen some troubling indicators in the manufacturing front recently. I'm highlighting one of the few industrials that seems to be working in this market. Do not miss my take on something blank soul. And last week's biggest IPO didn't take place on its average, and it took place on StockX's website. I'm getting to the bottom of it with the company CEO, and he may be better than the greatest of all time. Stay with Kramer.
Don't miss a second of Mad Money. Follow at Jim Cramer on Twitter. Have a question? Tweet Cramer. Hashtag Mad Tweets. Send Jim an email to madmoney@cnbc.com or give us a call at 1-800-743-CNBC. Miss something? Head to madmoney.cnbc.com.
What makes this market so hard to like? On the one hand, many of the problems we've been holding us back, in some cases for years, are starting to resolve themselves, right? I mean, the UK just kicked the can down the road again on Brexit, but maybe there's a resolution. The trade war with China is cooling, at least for the moment. The Fed's given us a much-needed rate cut. The job market's still strong. And so far, this earnings season is looking, I think, pretty darn well. Let's say maybe it's looking not as bad as feared. Nabuff! You'd think that that would give us a pretty positive backdrop. But for every hurdle we overcome, there's a new one standing in front of us. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the stock market has been flooded with new supply thanks to all these IPOs. Like any other market, when supply overwhelms demand, it puts pressure on prices. On top of that, we have a tremendous amount of political uncertainty from impeachment to the 2020 election. And Wall Street hates uncertainty. We had a boatload of it. For weeks now, many investors have been freaking out about Senator Elizabeth Warren's new status as a Democratic frontrunner. She's the candidate who wants to crack down on the perceived excesses of big business. The stock market represents big business. It's easy to understand why money managers are worried. However, look, no matter how you feel about President Trump, Wall Street likes his economic policies, aside from the trade war. So for the next year, it wouldn't surprise me if the averages bounce back and forth in response to the polling. I know that's a suboptimal situation. It's the last thing we want to worry about if it's Washington. We're trying to figure out companies. But this stuff is kind of nebulous. And it's very hard to look at with the kind of clinical detachment that you need to be a good investor. That's why tonight we do something different. We're going to go off the charts on a Monday with the help of Carly Garner. She's a brilliant technician. She's also the co-founder of DeCarly Trading and the author of Higher Probability Commodity Trading to get a more quantitative, more empirical read on this market. Now, Garner points out that the S&P 500 hasn't made much progress since it peaked last year. After rocketing higher from late 2016 through early 2018, the market spent most of the last couple of years digesting those gains and no more. Lately, though, the S&P surged to new highs, and Garner's concerned, this is quite contrary of what I'm hearing, that we may be approaching a point where all the good news is baked in. More importantly, she thinks we're about to encounter some serious technical resistance here. When you pair that with a glut of new stock from the IPO deluge, which I've told you is not done, like she said, Peloton today, even though it's recommended by everybody, and the political headwinds, well, she sees a, let's say, not so pretty picture. Let's take a look. Why does she expect resistance? This is a look at a very difficult concept, but we're going to try to walk through it. This is the weekly chart of the CBOE Volatility Index, the VIX for short, which is also known as the fear gauge, because it tends to do a good job of capturing the overall level of terror in the market. Technically, the VIX measures the volatility premium people are paying for S&P 500 options. It tends to go down when investors are complacent, and it goes up when they are afraid. See this? Is, you could argue, is a measure of complacency. Lately, the VIX has been pummeled. But when what Garner likes in this chart is the Commodity Futures Trading Commission's weekly commitments of traders report. That's the COT, okay? Which tells you what certain types of investors are doing with the VIX futures. What we care about here is the large speculator category, money managers, because it can give us some insight into when a trade may be many right or it may be too crowded. Keep that thought in your mind. Right now, the VIX future speculations are net short by about 155,000 contracts, not far from what Garner would consider to be an overheated short trade at around 170,000 contracts. See, 170,000, we'll put it up here, okay? I'm gonna keep all these. These are all important, so I don't want to. I know there's too much here, but this is really important because why does it matter? Because in the past, both the VIX and the S&P 500 have a habit of reversing. One speculator starts shorting the VIX futures too heavily. When the VIX spikes, the S&P tends to get crushed. All right, so you can see that, in other words, if this were to go back up, then the S&P would go like that, all right? Now, well, how about the S&P 500 itself? Take a look at this longer-term monthly chart of the S&P 500 December E-mini futures. That's a key contract everybody watches who trades the futures. In the short run, Garner thinks bullish seasonal patterns and optimism should be able to carry us higher. But if we rally much further from here, the relative strength index, and that's down here, RSI, okay, that's an important momentum indicator, will shift into overbought territory, suggesting that we'll be due for a pullback. Right now, the S&P is just above 3,000. Okay, so keep this in mind. This is where it is, all right? Garner's is expecting a ceiling resistance at 3030 or 3150. 3,150. This is the appropriate ceiling. Anywhere somewhere in between, maybe. Her focus is on the 3,060 to 3,090 area. It's possible to get there, get a short squeeze here, okay? A kind of bull trap move that tricks you into thinking everything's okay. That's what some people thought was happening today. If that ceiling holds, Garner says you want to be prepared for a sell-off, possibly for a severe one. So in other words, if we can't take this out, she wouldn't be surprised if we get a pullback down to the S&P's long-term floor, okay, of the 2500s. Get this, it'd be a hideous move, but it wouldn't negate the bull market. However, if the S&P breaks below the long-term, well, the Garner thinks a plunge under 2,000. Under 2,000 could be a real possibility. At the moment, though, she still considers that a pretty low probability outcome. So she thinks it goes to here, but if that doesn't hold, then she thinks it can go to here. That's a big decline. Then there's the monthly chart of the NASDAQ 100 of the tech-heavy index, made up of the 100 largest non-financial companies in the NASDAQ composite. At this point, the NASDAQ 100 has hit some pretty lofty levels. All the way up here, okay? Right now, the NDX is about 66 points away from 8,000, and Garner sees extreme resistance. The 8,100 level, 8,180 level is her resistance. But just like with the S&P, Gartner believes there's a chance for a temporary probe above resistance that may lure in buyers. If that happens, 82.40 becomes the ceiling. So in other words, we get some momentum players come in, not the kind of buyers you want. Also, just like the S&P, the NASDAQ 100 is not yet excessively overbought, and that's down here, according to the Relative Strength Index. However, if it keeps climbing, we'll soon reach overbought territory. And then Gartner expects this thing to roll over and roll over badly. How terribly could we be hit? In the normal ebb and flow of the market, she thinks we find a support at 6930 down here. But that's down about 1,000 points from where we are. But it wouldn't shock her if we got a more serious correction that takes us down to the floor at 5910, 5,910. Well, this is, ladies and gentlemen, this is a 25% decline. Is Gartner right? Honestly, I do not subscribe to her negativity. But you need to be aware that these bearish scenarios are on the table in a lot of people's heads. Here's the bottom line. The charts as interpreted by Carly Gartner suggest that the averages could keep climbing for the next few weeks. But after that, she thinks we're in real trouble. And she recommends using any of the strength we're about to get to ring the register. My view, look, it never hurts to be a little cautious as we keep climbing. I think there's more to the bull market than Gartner gives it credit for. Still, we need her perspective. She's been right on a lot of things. Because now if things do start rolling over, you'll understand what the tech will say about the possible downside in front of us. Stick with Kramer. Hey, this week we get results from a bunch of major industrials. United Technologies, Caterpillar, Stanley Black & Decker, Illinois Tool Works, just to name a few. I'm optimistic about some of these stories, especially United Technologies, but for the most part, Wall Street's expectations are incredibly low. See, the industrials, they've been hammered as investors fret about that worldwide economic slowdown and the trade war. These are all things that are so negative for earnings. But I've got an exception, or an exceptional one, though. Last Thursday, we got a terrific beat and raise quarter from a company I don't talk about at all, a company called Dover, all right? It's a classic smokestack stock. It's just exactly the kind of dirty industrial you expect to be really struggling here. Yet Dover caught fire with the stock up 46% for the year. 46, that's extraordinary. So how is it even possible? And more importantly, can it keep climbing? Okay, this company is a manufacturer's manufacturer. Dover gets 40% of its sales from its fluid handling division. Think pumps, compressors, and bearing systems that are used by industrials, oil companies, chemical companies, and gas stations, and even the food and pharma industry. They get another 40% of their sales from engineered systems, where Dover makes critical equipment, consumables, and components for all sorts of industries, consumer goods, digital textile printing, vehicle service, environmental solutions, industrial automation, defense, telco, you name it. Finally, the last 20 comes from refrigeration and food equipment, which includes equipment for everything from commercial refrigeration to heating and cooling to food and beverage packaging. It exhausts me to say it all. In short, though, Dover's a textbook example of a smokestack stock. Historically, it's the kind of stock that gets crushed during any kind of economic slowdown, even an international one. Given that this company gets 44% of its sales from overseas, they moved aggressively overseas. That's what it should have done. That's where the growth is supposed to be. It's not exactly immune to worldwide weakness. But in the last few years, Dover's moved aggressively to take control of its own destiny rather than just hope for the strength of the globe. These guys don't want to be just another cyclical enterprise that's totally hostage to the rise and fall of the business cycle. It all started in late 2017, right here. For years, this stock had been obviously an underperformer, held back by its ailing energy business known as WellSite. They made equipment for the oil and gas industry, so ever since the price of crude peaked in 2014, Dover's energy division became a total dog. In 2016, again in 2017, WellSite sales were down more than 25% year over year. Every time I would listen to one of their conference calls, I would say, what the hell? Why don't they just get out of that darn business? Well, by September 2017, management had enough. They threw in the towel. They announced a strategic review. And a few months later, they decided to amputate the energy business via a tax-free spinoff. Dover had WellSite borrow hundreds of millions of dollars to pay their shareholders a big, fat, special dividend. Then spun it off as a new company called Apergy in April of last year. At that point, they washed their hands of the whole thing. It was a clean break. Dover retained zero ownership interest. Bon voyage, Apergy. In retrospect, that was a great decision. The price of oil has been stuck in the 50s because every time it starts getting some lift, what happens? Well, you know, our producers bring on more supply and knock it right back down. And that's why the oil service stocks have been such awful performers until perhaps today when Halliburton reported a not hideous number. It was a NAV if it was not as bad as feared. But Apergy's lost roughly a third of its value since the spinoff. Why did Dover make that call? In part, it's because Third Point, the huge activist hedge fund run by the very smart Dan Loeb, took a position in the company and started to push for it. I think Loeb laid much of the groundwork for this turnaround, although he didn't stick around to see it, but bailing on the stock roughly a year ago, right into the market-wide meltdown. In April of last year, Dover's longtime CEO stepped down. Dover brought in Richard Tobin, then the CEO of CNH Industrial. That's a major British manufacturer, to replace him. And 13 months ago, Tobin rolled out a huge restructuring program. He called it a right-sizing plan to bolster Dover's margins, improve operations, and build a foundation for future growth. Basically, wanted to cut costs and narrow the company's focus, which includes jettisoning a lot of underperforming businesses. In practice, Tobin has trimmed the portfolio, focusing on areas where Dover has proprietary edge and can't easily be replaced by a cheaper alternative, as well as businesses that can give them recurring revenue growth. We love recurring growth. And man, this guy has delivered. Dover reported a series of strong quarters this year. Execution's been fabulous. Big cost cuts, better management of the company's two core businesses, engineered systems, and fluid handling. However, once we started worrying about a worldwide slowdown, things seemed to get a little dicey. When Dover reported in July, okay, here we go, their sales came in a bit light, even if they still delivered a nice earnings beat. Overall orders were soft. They were down 2% organically. That freaked a lot of people out, although its fluid handling business stayed strong. Still, management said their engineered systems business was hit by a delay in digital printing orders, and they told us to expect better in the second half. They also raised their low end of their full-year earnings forecast. Nah, it wasn't enough. Stock got hit, only pulling back to $88. It slows in August as the industrials went out of style with the trade war. China escalated, investors freaked, all that stuff, you know, blah, blah, blah. Fast forward to last month. Dover holds this big investor meeting where they spelled out everything they've done to improve their businesses. Over the past decade, the company's become a smarter, more streamlined business, fewer operating units. They went from 35, who can keep track of that, down to 18. That may still be too many, but much less cyclical and faster organic growth. Management also gave us some ambitious margin expansion targets for their fuelings, solutions, and food retail divisions. Put it all together, and Dover of today is a very different company from the Dover of just even a few years ago. While the stocks shot up back to the triple digits in response to this meeting, it pulled back hard earlier this month. By the time Dover reported last Thursday, it was trading at $95. In other words, the stock wasn't burdened by great expectations. NABF, right? And if they delivered a good quarter, their share price was bound to go higher, and that's exactly what happened. It posted a 9-cent earnings beat off a $1.51 basis, higher than expected revenues, terrific 6% organic growth. Remember, it was down 2 before. Plus, as promised, the engineered systems business did indeed turn around, up 6%. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Bountiful's Dover's operating margins also increased by 180 basis points. Even better, management once again raised the low end of the full-year forecast. Now they're looking for 582 to 585 per share. And that's why the stock jumped nearly 6% on Thursday and tacked on another couple of points over the past two trading days. Put it all together, and the heavy industrial Dover continues to deliver, even though the macro guys would tell you it shouldn't. Fabulous execution, worldwide slowdown doesn't seem to be hurting them, and the stock's not too expensive, 16 times earnings. Can it go higher? Yeah, I think it can. Going to the end of the year, I bet money managers will flock into the few industrial names that are actually working, and one of them will be Dover. As I said at the top, the Honeywell pin action extends to a bunch of industrials. Dover's the same way because of the broad range of its businesses it dominates. Company's a quiet, solid manufacturer of boring specialty products. The kind of operation you might never even know about unless you're one of their customers, and that's what's working. Bottom line, Dover has transformed itself into a much less cyclical kind of industrial. That's why it's been able to rally in a tougher macroeconomic environment. It's why I think the stock is more upside going forward. It has reinvented itself by self-help. Just the kind of moves we are looking to triumph over a global economic slowdown. Let's go to Michael in my home state of New Jersey. Michael!
Booyah, Jim.
Booyah, Michael.
Listen, China is going to be buying 40 to 50 billion more in agriculture. Should we be buying SMG, some more Scotts Miracle-Gro fertilizer?
Well, actually, the problem with that is that first, we don't know if they're going to buy it. And second, Scotts Miracle-Gro is really more about grass and grass, which used to be what we called cannabis, before cannabis decided it was too, tacky to call it grass. Anyway, Wall Street isn't a fan of the industrials right now, but I've spotted a major exception. Other than Honeywell, It's Dover, and that's because it's transformed itself, and I think you can go even higher. Much more Mad Money ahead. A NASDAQ for sneakerheads? I'm finding out how one e-commerce site is taking aim at the luxury market, then selling off like it's 1999. I'm digging into whether the derailing we're seeing in the NASDAQ right now is comparable to the meltdown of tech stocks in 1999 to 2000. Here I'm speaking about the cloud-based stocks. How do you handle it? And all your calls rapid-fire tonight's edition of the Lightning Round. So stay with Cramer.
This company is more than just shoes by the share. Sneakerheads, who get more than a kick out of their kicks, are making a market that has footwear fans jumping in with both feet. Is the business model of StockX a shoe-in for success?
If you want to get a read on the future of retail, you need to check in with the smaller, privately held companies that are revolutionizing the industry. Take StockX, which is a kind of marketplace for things like limited edition sneakers, watches, handbags, streetwear. They got their start helping people selling rare shoes. And since then, they've expanded into a whole bunch of categories. Now, in the last few months, StockX has rolled out yet another category, collectibles. They brought in a new CEO, and just last week, they launched their latest shoe IPO as part of a collaboration with Adidas. StockX shoe IPOs, they're kind of like Dutch auctions. We're going to learn more about them. Don't worry about it. They're a set of numbers of shoes. If you want one, you submit a bid with the shoes going to the highest bidders who all pay the same price. Hey, that's kind of an intriguing idea. So let's dig deeper with Scott Cutler. He's the new CEO of StockX to learn more about his company and how it's changing the industry. Mr. Cutler, welcome to Mad Money.
Great to be here, Jim.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Now, Scott reminded me beforehand that we met while you were on the New York Stock Exchange explaining Alibaba to me. At the same time, you've been at eBay. You are kind of Mr. Exchange. So how'd you come to get the job and what's it like?
Well, you know, when this company started, they started with this notion of creating a new commerce marketplace based on the principles of the New York Stock Exchange, StubHub, and eBay, all places where I'd either been CEO or been part of senior management.
Right.
And I sent a text, a LinkedIn message to Josh Luber, one of the founders. Hey, Josh, I'm the CEO at StubHub. I'm a sneakerhead. I see what you're doing. I spent 10 years in the exchange. I know exactly how big this idea is. I'd love to help. And that started a three-year
relationship. That's how it started?
You just did it
through LinkedIn?
Yeah. A day after they started. I saw the idea, and I thought it was just transformational, the combination of all of these things together in this company. And then who would have known a few years later that I would join and have the opportunity to run it in partnership with the founders? But it's been, you know, really very cool story.
Well, who else would know how to do an IPO auction? Tell us about it. And I wanted to be sure I mentioned before that even though it's with Adidas, there are a lot of brands involved.
Yeah, you know, so the concept here is actually pretty simple. So we partner with a great brand, an innovative brand in Adidas. And you had three unique designers from around the world. And in 10 days, they designed, created, and produced these unique sneakers, three different colorways. And we had an IPO for 333 pairs of each sneaker. And like you said, so this is the first time where a brand comes direct into the marketplace and allows the consumer to dictate the price that they're willing to pay for these rare, one-of-a-kind sneakers.
And people can be off their mark and still not get hurt. Let's say a pair, actually, the average is for $200. You can put in $1,000, but you don't have to pay $1,000.
Well, we had 10,000 bids.
How do people know about this stuff?
Well, I mean, we did a lot. We launched this last week. It was open for just a couple of days. We had bidders from all around the world. We already have customers from 170 countries, but 20% of the 10,000 bidders came from outside of the United States. 1,000 of those bidders placed bids on all three different pairs. And when it came down to it, when you talked about the average clearing price was a little over $200 across all three, and 90% of the bidders paid less than what they bid on the sneakers.
Extraordinary. Now, you know eBay and StubHub. Are you starting to see better price discovery here than you did in eBay?
Well, this is a totally different model in the sense that, first of all, you know, in this case for sneakers category, these are always new dead stock items.
Right.
And so we intermediate that transaction, means we stand in the middle. So
right,
between
right.
every anonymous buyer and seller, we authenticate that you know, that item. And so it's different than other online marketplaces because we stand in the middle of the transaction. In this case, yes, there are other platforms that do an auction, but not a blind Dutch auction right. in this format that we are very familiar with in the, you know, in the public markets. And we use this mechanism to to price a traditional, you know, IPO, but here we use it for products and commerce.
How is it possible international must be, like eBay, international yeah, took off.
Absolutely.
Are people just more comfortable in international? I mean, why do they seem to like it? And that's where the business seems to be going.
Well, the business internationally is growing unbelievably. Sneakers is a worldwide phenomenon.
Right.
It's driven by social, but ultimately it's about access for people in all the countries outside of the United States having that opportunity to cop a new sneaker.
China,
just,
too?
Yeah, China, 10% of our business.
Isn't that so?
Direct. An e-commerce company having direct customers in China. So these are items that you can't get anywhere else, but then they're coming to StockX, and we're recognized as a brand that stands for authenticity. And
right.
so since we authenticate everything that goes through the platform, if you're buying from, you know, anywhere in the world, you know that you're getting a great brand plus this notion of authenticity.
Oh, that's fantastic. Then no one else has that, which means brings me to a point that the people at home are saying, you know what, I want to be on StockX, but I also want a piece of StockX. I mean, is it reasonable to think, and I know Dan, a great man, is behind it,
yeah.
that you would want to come public? Or is it like the mortgage operation where I don't think there's any desire to go public?
Well, if you see, we recently announced a financing at the beginning of the
right.
summer. We raised over $100 million. We have world-class investors, including Dan, that are in this. And I think, wouldn't that be great if we ended up with that outcome? That's certainly our objective as a company.
Fantastic.
But we're going after a global opportunity with consumers around the world, and we're super excited about this innovation in commerce.
Well, you should be. This is exciting. They got the right guy for it. You know it all. All right, that's Scott Cutler, CEO of StockX. Guys, go read about Google it. I really want you to know about this. I know it's private, so you can't take a position, but this is one of the most exciting parts of commerce I've seen since when eBay was started. Man, money's back after the break. It is time! It's time for the light worker! What's up, Rocco? One of those is and then the lightning round is over. Are you ready, Steve? Get it! Time for the light worker! What's up with Bill in Pennsylvania? Bill!
Jim, I got the backbone of some of the most popular websites in the world. Third quarter results coming up on November 7th. What do you think about Cloudflare?
They have taken that one to the woodshed. I've got to tell you, I think you're now going to have to start dealing with a lot of tax law selling. I would be careful. I do like the idea, but wow, has it been clobbered. That's not a good sign. Let's go to Rohit in Washington. Rohit.
Hey, Jim. Love your show and
thank
follow
you
on Twitter. Thank you for everything. I wanted to get your thoughts on AMD. It's been
I like it. I like what Lisa Su's doing. A lot of notes today saying she's still kicking the butt of Intel. Holy cow. But remember, NVIDIA is also on fire. Let's go to Sharon in California. Sharon.
Your show.
Thank
I'm
you.
I'm turning 75 this week. I've been in the dividend reinvestment plan of Exelon for many years.
Good.
Having accrued a lot of shares and gains over time.
Good for you.
Should I stay the course?
Yes, absolutely. First, a happy 75th. Look, Exelon's not my favorite. It's the old Philly Elect and Commonwealth. Ed, I happen to like Dominion right here for 4.5, but I think you stick with what you got, and you're in very good hands, and I like your call. Let's go to Richard in Tennessee. Richard!
Hey, Jim, this is Stock Monster Rich from Knoxville, Tennessee. I love ENDP. I want to know what you think about it, and I think it's a steal at these levels.
Well, I can't call it a steal. Let's just say it's a great spec down here at 4. I can't call it a steal because every time you call something a steal, it's like calling it a no-brainer. Next thing that happens is that you got no brain. Let's go to Ashwin in California. Ashwin.
Hey, Jim, thanks for taking my call and appreciate all your insights. My symbol is MRK, Merck.
Okay, Merck reports October 29th. Here's what you need to know about Merck. Merck will print, there'll be someone who doesn't like it, they'll knock the stock down, and then you'll buy more. Or they'll get too excited about it, and then it'll get knocked down. So the secret is buy half Merck now and half Merck after it starts going down on the day it reports, because it will be a good quarter. Let's go to Gunther in Florida. Gunther.
Booyah, Mr. Kramer. Booyah, this is Gunther from Palm Harbor in Florida. I have that question. Is Ionis Pharmaceutical a good stock to own in the long run?
It's fine. It's a battleground. It's got a lot of short people in the shorts banging it down and taking it up. I have to tell you, I like the Seattle Genetics. That was good news. And the Vertex news, even though it's up a lot, it's not up enough. I like both those better. Let's go to Andrew in South Carolina. Andrew. Andrew.
I have his phone number. He didn't answer. I left him a voicemail. Then I called. I looked up Steve Smith.
Well, that's a little confusing to me. What's the stock?
Hey, I'm looking into... Hey, booyah, Chris. Booyah. Just wanted to get a shout-out and see what you think about Tandem Diabetics.
I like Tandem Diabetics. It's done absolutely nothing since they recommended it. It seems to want to do nothing. I don't care. I like the stock. I also, by the way, you know, I like Dexmed. I like Medtronic, which is down a lot. And that, ladies and gentlemen, of the Lightning Round.
The Lightning Round is sponsored by TD Ameritrade.
It finally happened. I hardly noticed. All year I've been warning you that the flood of new IPOs would eventually derail many of those turbocharged growth stocks in the NASDAQ that we like so much. If you want to participate in a deal, you need to sell something, though. You have to sell something else. And lately, money managers have been selling the software as a service plays. Anything cloud-related has been slammed. I'm blaming the IPO market. When this year began, I was worried it would end up looking like the end of the dot-com era. Back in 2000, we had two markets, the NASDAQ Composites, which was filled with pretenders like Infospace and eToys and WorldCom and Global Crossing. And then there was the real market made up of the Coca-Colas and the Mercks. From 1999 to 2000, more than 350 companies came public, flooding the market with endless amounts of stock, both from the IPOs and from their secondary offerings. There was too much new supply and it only overwhelmed demand. Then the whole dot-com edifice came crashing down, even the good ones, by the way. They all got eviscerated. And then, well, Wall Street soured on things tech and rotated back to the Cokes and the Pepsis, the high-quality companies with consistent earnings and good dividends and buybacks. Only a half dozen companies really survived. Now, we're seeing something similar. The cloud stocks are being clubbed, though fortunately, there aren't that many of them, at least not compared to the dot-com period, and some of the cloud names are even profitable. But it doesn't matter. Money's flowing back to consistent companies with healthy dividends as long as they don't have too much China exposure. That's what we've been seeing in the Dow. Once again, the new supply from IPOs has overwhelmed the natural demand from buyers. This happened sooner than I thought because there's a lot less demand for individual stocks than there used to be. These days, indexing has become the default way most people invest. Almost 60% of the money in the stock market comes via the indices. And the indices aren't allowed, per se, to participate in IPOs because they're not in the index. I mean, that's kind of what we don't want to have happen, isn't it? Wow. Plus, many of these junior growth companies like to issue stock as salary, which means there's a constant flood of additional supply. Like, it's like weak shale underneath a skyscraper. It doesn't help that many of the IPOs are unicorns, and soon their lockups will start to expire. Do you know, forget this, Uber's lockup on its insider sales ends in a few weeks. We're going to get with $22 billion worth of the stock. That's four times the current float. Thank you, Larry McDonald, for Bear Traps, for putting that work together. And Uber's hardly alone here. You put it all together, and this situation is just too darn similar to the dot-com unraveling. We don't want this, but it is. It's almost like the stock market's equivalent of Gresham's Law. Bad money's driving out the good. In this case, the weakness from unprofitable, newly public companies bleeds into the profitable but expensive cloud names. Did you see the way Peloton acted today? There were five firms that told you to buy it. Yeah, these one red-hot group of cloud stocks is really plummeting to earth. Oh, and the software outlook from Workday last week took everybody by surprise. So what do you do? If you don't own any of the cloud stocks, I think you got to let them settle. If you do own the higher quality cloud plays that are being brought down with the bad ones, you have my permission to picket them into weakness. But please be mindful that the whole group is under pressure and could have a potentially lot more downside. I wish I could offer more reassurance, but the vast supply of new stock just snuck up on us, and it's causing the whole group to get hit. These IPOs are a tsunami, and it's just not worth trying to fight it. Better to get out of the way. Oh, the only piece of good news? At least we weren't annihilated by WeWork. The damage was cordoned to the so-called professionals who got their lungs ripped out by an overly dynamic entrepreneur with a terrific story and a real bad balance sheet. Stick with Kramer. Speaking of Naboff, guess what? Ameritrade reported tonight, and again, it was not as bad as people feared, and the stock roared. That remains the operable theme of this quarter, other than the industrials who helped themselves. I like to say there's always a bull market somewhere, and I promise I'll try to find it just for you, right here on Mad Money. I'm Jim Cramer, and I will see you tomorrow!